First time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting the U.S. deployed the first elements of its Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System to South Korea Tuesday. Admiral Harry Harris, the commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, says THAAD elements were deployed because of commitments to South Korea and the need to defend U.S. interests and allies. Like the Patriot system, THAAD uses its own missiles to shoot down incoming enemy missiles. Malaysia is barring all North Koreans, including diplomats and embassy staff, from leaving the country. At the same time, North Korea is banning all Malaysians from leaving its territory. The two nations continue their diplomatic battle, which was kicked off last month by the killing of the half-brother of North Korea's leader. The decisions Tuesday followed the mutual expulsion of each nation's ambassador. Iraq, now removed from U.S. travel restrictions, praised the new executive order on immigration President Donald Trump signed Monday. But Sudan, still included in the ban, reaffirmed its opposition to the measure. The order's 90-day ban on the issuance of new visas applies now to six countries: Iran, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan. In Nigeria, the government released a travel advisory suggesting people postpone any plans to go to the United States until the immigration policy is clear. A key monitoring group says Syrian troops backed by Russian air power have regained control of a key pumping station near the Turkish border from the Islamic State group. The facility at Al-Kafsa, which supplies Syria's second-largest city, Aleppo, with most of its water, was shuttered by IS fighters nearly 8 weeks ago, forcing the city's residents to rely on wells and private vendors. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump says a new Republican plan to overhaul the country's national health care system is wonderful. U.S. Health Secretary Tom Price spoke to reporters at the White House about the plan.
We think it's incredibly important for the American people to be able to select the physician and the place where they're treated themselves, that the government ought not be involved in that process. And so our goal is to make certain that individuals have the opportunity to select their physician.
Opposition to the plan is coming from hardline Republicans as well as Democrats. A conservative backlash against the plan is threatening to scuttle the whole thing. Several public school districts in the United States will be forced to close classrooms Wednesday after teachers said they would skip school to participate in the so-called Day Without a Woman. The strike has been called to protest President Donald Trump. President Trump took to Twitter Tuesday to deny reports that there is infighting among White House staffers, calling it fake news. Mr. Trump said, "We are getting along great and getting major things done." Mr. Trump made his remarks after several days of accounts in major U.S. news outlets of turmoil in the White House. The White House has reopened public tours for the first time since President Trump took office. Peter Heinlein reports.
The line of visitors erupted in cheers as President Donald Trump himself greeted them at the White House door. The president offered the visitors a bit of advice.
Work hard, everybody, work hard.
The tours had been suspended temporarily during the presidential transition, prompting some complaints from members of Congress who have the sole privilege of distributing the tickets to constituents and others visiting the Capitol. Tickets are free and can be requested up to 3 months in advance. Peter Heinlein, the White House.
The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee said Tuesday he has seen no evidence to support President Donald Trump's allegation that the Obama administration tapped his phones during the election campaign. Devin Nunes said if the charges were true, his committee would have been briefed about it. Nunes announced that his committee will investigate the matter. Among those invited for public testimony are James Comey. He's the director of the FBI. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres Tuesday urged the international community to send help to people starving in Somalia. He made an urgent visit to the nation Tuesday and was visibly shocked by the suffering that he saw. Former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega suffered a hemorrhage after surgery Tuesday. The operation was to remove a benign brain tumor. His daughters report that he is now in critical condition. The online leaker WikiLeaks has published thousands of pages of what it says are confidential CIA documents that expose an alleged hacking program employed by the Central Intelligence Agency. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, March 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Lesotho will hold yet another election this June, its third since 2012.
Since we have been good, loyal friend of the masses on the ground, we have to go back and encourage them to go out to vote in large numbers.
Motumi Rahejo is the spokesperson for now former Prime Minister Pakalita Mosisile of Lesotho. Three Gambian political parties have formed an alliance ahead of April's parliamentary elections. Civil society groups in South Sudan say their effort to help alleviate famine is being curtailed by a restrictive law on NGOs. And Malawi struggles to retain nurses in its public hospitals.
They quit on us because we cannot pay them well. Most of them are joining the NGOs or to private. So they go to where they are paid a bit more money and also where they have more incentives.
Dorothy Ongoma is the president of the Malawi National Association of Nurses and Midwifery. The Green Girls Project in Cameroon turns garbage into gas, and African cinemas are making a comeback with a private funding. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Lesotho will hold yet another election in early June this year, the country's third since 2012. This after King Letsie III dissolved the parliament on Tuesday, a week after Prime Minister Pakalita Mosisile lost a vote of no confidence. Mosisile, in power for 2 years, has seen his support weakened by mass defections from his ruling coalition to the opposition. Former Prime Minister Thomas Thabane returned home last month from his self-imposed exile in South Africa and vowed to legally overthrow Mosisile's government. Motume Rahejo, Prime Minister Mosisile's spokesperson, says although the ruling Democratic Congress Party coalition suffered defections recently, it still believes it can't convince the Basotho people to re-elect Mosisile in June because the party has been a loyal friend of the masses.
We use a Westminster system whereby if the parliament feels that the prime minister has not performed, then they put forward a motion of no confidence. And upon the debate of that motion, then if the motion is carried like it did, then the prime minister immediately within 3 days, he has to act. And then at this time, the prime minister did act, went to see His Majesty the King and advised the king to dissolve parliament and call for an early election. So this is what happened.
In that vote of no confidence, your party lost us, I think it was, 74 to 120. So what are your chances now that you can stay in power come June?
Well, yes. We believe that following the split within my party, that we have to go back to the voters and convince them that since we have been good, loyal friend of the masses on the ground, we have to go back and report back to them and also encourage them to go out to vote in large numbers.
The former Prime Minister Thomas Thabane returned home last month, and upon his return, he promised to legally overthrow your government. So how concerned are you that the party of the former prime minister, the All Basotho Convention, might seize power come June?
Well, as a democratic nation, it is the right of our own people to ensure that our democracy grows. And we believe that our party, the Democratic Congress, together with its partners, are going to jointly work very hard in spreading the message to our own people and convince them that we are still their most trusted political party, and they can be assured that we will continue to work for them.
So you are not concerned about the threat made by Mr. Thabane?
Not necessarily not concerned. We believe that what ABC does, we have to do it better. And we have to ensure that we convince people more. And they also, on the other hand, permitted by the Constitution and the democracy that is growing in our country, they have the right also to go out there and also talk to the people and also ensure that they convince the people to march to their party And this is how our democracy will grow.
What do you think Prime Minister Pak Kalita has done, where I think the Southern African community were trying to bring about some kind of reconciliation in Lesotho? What has the Prime Minister done to bring about that kind of atmosphere in Lesotho?
We have achieved a number of conditions, the recommendations that were put forward by SADC itself. We were asked by SADC to prepare a roadmap, which we have done, and also we ensured that we had a Gantt chart that showed what's going to be done. There was, and there is still is, progress with regards to what we were going to do with regard to the reforms. You remember that we're supposed to reform Parliament itself, to reform the Constitution itself, to reform security in the country, to reform also the judiciary itself and also the public service. So this government has been pushing to ensure that some of those recommendations are in place.
Motumi Ralejo is the spokesperson for now former Prime Minister Pak Kalita Mosisili of the Kingdom of Lesotho. He was speaking with me from the capital, Maseru. Three political parties in the Gambia have agreed to join forces for the upcoming National Assembly elections scheduled for April this year. The parties are the United Democratic Party, the National Reconciliation Party, and the Gambia Moral Congress Party. Sidney Marina reports from Banjul.
The event was presided over by President Adama Barrow, who unseated Gambia's longtime ruler, Yahya Jammeh.
It's a byproduct of our common desire to create a peaceful, unstable political environment underpinned by a transparent and democratic political dispensation, without which the prosperity, happiness, well-being of our people will be compromised. The MOU aims to give dignity and respect to the office of the president and that of political opposition and encourage them to become partners in national construction and development.
Aliu Momorunjai is the chairman of Independent Electoral Commission. He was forced to flee into exile at the peak of the political crisis in Genoa, but has since returned to take charge of election matters.
The document that is now before all of you is a byproduct of consensus building in good faith in the public interest by the three political parties, currently numbering 9.
The signing of the agreement brought together opposition and leaders of various parties in the new coalition government. Fabakar Tombonjato, a top official of the former president party, now in the opposition.
All political parties are geared towards serving the people of the country. So I think it's a step in the right direction, and we are hopeful that all of us will try to abide by the conditions inherent in the document. He said it in very clear terms. I cannot say anything better than what he said. To ensure accountability, transparency, rule of law, good governance, and of course prosperity for the Gambian people. I will want to state this, that we would be an opposition with a difference. We will hail them when they do good, but we will shout foul when it is wrong.
Former opposition leader of the United Democratic Party and now Minister of Foreign Affairs, lawyer Usenu Dabo, also shares his view on the agreement.
Well, it means that the Gambian political parties are committed to really function as two political parties, respecting the laws of the land. After all, everything in the memorandum of understanding, you will find it in the laws of the Gambia. We are just recommitting ourselves, rededicating ourselves to observing and respecting the laws of the country. That is all we are doing.
For the leader of the People Democratic Party for Independence and Socialism and coalition government spokesperson, Khalifa Sa,
the signing ceremony is the final consummation of the process of negotiation which started a year ago. The whole objective was to create an environment where political leaders will not see themselves as enemies, but as partners who may compete for political office. But notwithstanding, they are all citizens of a country which expects them to serve the people with diligence to ensure that they deliver liberty, justice, and prosperity.
Reporting for VOA News, I am Sini M.K. Marina in Banjul.
Today's Wednesday, March 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Malawi's public health system is in dire need of nurses, but recruiting trained staff remains difficult as many registered nurses prefer the higher pay and better working conditions they can find in private hospitals or abroad. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre on what is being done to address the nurses' shortage.
In a pediatric ward at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital, the largest referral health facility in Malawi, mothers look frustrated because of a long wait for a nurse to check on their children. A visit to other outpatient wards reveals more packed waiting rooms. Such is the situation in public hospitals across Malawi, where 65% of nursing positions remain vacant. Malawi's National Association of Nurses and Midwifery President Dorothy Ngoma says it's a matter of economics.
They quit on us because we cannot pay them well. Most of them are joining the NGOs or to private. So they go to where they are paid a bit more money and also where they have more incentives.
She said incentives can include housing allowances and overtime pay, and private sector salaries can be double what private hospitals offer. Health Ministry spokesperson Adrian Chikumbe says the government cannot afford to pay more.
The government space now is the constraint, and we have not only health workers to provide for, we also have got other cadres in the civil service.
Government statistics show that Malawi has 3 nurses per 10,000 people. That is well below the World Health Organization recommendation of 10 nurses for every 10,000 people. To fill vacancies, the Health Ministry says it has more than tripled the number of students in its nurse training institutions from 40 to 150 per class. A U.S.-based NGO, the Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance, has also been trying to address the gap. GAIA sponsors education for nursing students in Malawi who commit to work in public hospitals for the first 4 years after they graduate. Scholarship Program Project Officer Chimwemwe Mangonde explains.
Throughout, we support the tuition and also the upkeep. At the end of their program in fourth year, we also pay for the license exams for them to work anywhere in the country, be it in the hospital or in the community.
The program has supported more than 500 registered nurses since its inception in 2005. GAIA is now seeking funding to double the program's annual intake to as many as 80 students a year. Statistics from the recent program evaluation report show that 93% of the graduated nurses have honored their public service commitment, and those nurses who have met the requirement, nearly all of them have continued to work in public hospitals. One of them is Patricia Siabu.
Nowadays it's hard to work in the government considering this and the amount of money that we get comparing with how much people get in the NGOs. But I still love working in the government because it's my desire to serve the government. So I have no dreams of going to the NGOs yet, not now.
And that is the concern. Not yet, she said. Recruiting new nurses to work in public hospitals is one challenge. Retaining them over the long term is another one entirely. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Civil society organizations in South Sudan trying to prevent more famine and the outbreak of diseases say their work is being curtailed by a 2016 restrictive law on NGOs, widespread insecurity, and a decrease in capacity of donors. Nabil Biajo has the story from Juba.
The group Humanity United South Sudan organized a panel discussion in Juba for humanitarian and civil society organizations who face major challenges trying to reach people in need. Bongiri Peter Lado is the director of Humanity South Sudan. He says after the conflict that broke out in late 2013 and flared up again in July last year, humanitarian groups have been needed more than ever before.
Civil society organizations play a very, very crucial part in this time of conflict where there are many, many tasks that are supposed to be done to ensure that peace goes well.
Lado says the most pressing humanitarian need in the country is addressing the famine recently declared in 2 counties of South Sudan. Lado says the 2016 law restricting the work of local organizations like Humanity South Sudan to one estate only renders them powerless in providing assistance to other needy communities, such as those affected by hunger in the former Unity State. Lado says the law also makes it impossible to assist people affected by violence and displacement in neighboring Yei River State.
For instance, there was a violence that occurred in Lanya, and people are going 3 months without food, and we take the risk to highlight about the issue. You are only registered in Juba, you cannot operate in Lanya. You see, Lanya is a Yei River State. When I talk on behalf of Yei River State, the government will ask you why you are not registered in Yei River State.
NGOs also complain about the red tape and expensive registration fees created under the new law. Obale Isaac, director of Youth Vision South Sudan, agrees that the current crisis means all civil society organizations should be given unfettered access to help wherever they can.
The measles is already one of the things that the World Health Organization have already suspected in the Republic of South Sudan. There is also incident of drought that the USAID also have suspected that in the maybe the coming 2 or 1 month, it will also affect South Sudan. So those ones, we need that we work in hand with the national and maybe the partner organization to bring us on board that we can reach those communities.
Florence Ide Noka, chairperson of Liwolo Development Association, says the sprawling humanitarian needs in South Sudan are compounded by the fact that donors do not feel safe in the country, so they're leaving.
People are scattered now, but there is movement of people around. They are going, even the donors are going, because the situation is not good. We cannot gain funds.
Noka says in order to address the critical humanitarian needs of its people, the government must first make peace and give local and international aid workers unhindered access to relieve the suffering of the South Sudanese. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The 25th edition of Africa's largest film festival, FESPACO, has ended. The main venue, as always, was the old and respectable Cinebok Kena in the heart of the capital, Ouagadougou. The city used to have at least 9 dedicated cinemas. Now only 2 remain. However, this year's FESPACO coincided with the opening of a brand new screening venue, the multifunctional Canal Olympia. And there's more good news across the region. Cinemas are reopening or being built. Brian Postmos has the story from Ouagadougou.
Fast food, Dakar, Senegal, cinema, Paris. Cinema, Paris.
Don't go looking for the Cinéma de Paris, the old film temple at the Place de l'Indépendance in downtown Dakar, the Senegalese capital. It's gone. It was knocked down in 2006 and the hole it left behind was filled with hotels and office blocks. The picture is repeated across the continent. Go to the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, and you will find the number of cinemas is...
0. In Yaoundé, for instance, we are 3 million. But we don't have no single cinema functioning.
Cameroonian culture journalist Parfait Tabapsi is lamenting the lack of film venues in his own city. The arrival of DVDs and the failure of the big cinemas to go digital are some of the reasons for their demise in West Africa. People can watch the latest Hollywood flicks, often pirated of course, for a pittance on TVs at little neighbourhood viewing spots. But try to find any African films besides perhaps a bit of Nollywood and you will be disappointed. Changing that is at the heart of Tabapsi's work in Cameroon with an organisation called Mobile Digital Cinema.
Our aim is to bring movie to the places they cannot go because of there is no communication means. There is no electricity, the roads are bad, but those people need to see artists, directors, tell the story about Africa. So we went there, we buy film, rights of film, and we go there and screening for free.
And now, belatedly, the old-fashioned cinema is catching up. FESPACO joined the digital age 2 editions ago when it announced that directors were no longer required to deliver their films in the expensive and cumbersome 35mm format. You can see this generational shift elsewhere in the industry. Here's the young Ivorian film director and actress Kadi Touré, living proof that you can make a homegrown movie and make money.
In Ivory Coast, we only have like one big company that have three cinemas. They were blown away. They are still asking me, how did you do it? This is the first time in the history they see a line, a queue of people just wanting to see an African movie.
Touré's film, L'Interprète, is the biggest box office hit in Ivorian history. It's a story about the many twists and turns in the love life of an Abidjan woman who works as an interpreter. It's a story about us, as she puts it. That's why people queue around the block to see it. Touré is investing the proceeds into the sequel. Elsewhere, her fellow African directors are working equally hard to have their film shown at home. The award-winning Chadian Mohamed Saleh Haroun single-handedly revived Le Normandie in the capital N'Djamena. And here, in Burkina Faso, another mythical cinema, Gimbi, in the country's second city, Bobo-Dioulasso, is under full reconstruction, as the project's spokeswoman Rosalie Zida explains. She says it will be the only cinema in this city of 1 million. The reconstruction started in mid-2015 and is the initiative of local filmmakers with the help of friends in Belgium and France. One hall will open later this year and the full complex will be delivered in 2018. And soon people will be flocking to another brand new place, the Canal Olympia, here in Ouagadougou. Part of a series of multifunctional culture venues owned by the French chain Canal Plus and already present in Conakry. So, what's the takeaway from all this as FESPACO goes into its habitual 2-year slumber? That mostly private initiatives are helping to resurrect African cinema, and that this applies to the buildings and to what's shown on the big screens. Produce it, and they will come. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
It's hard to teach young women about getting ahead through technology when they don't even have enough light to study. That was the problem facing the Green Girls Project in Cameroon. So project leaders took a break from their lessons to focus on solving that problem. As VOA's Kevin Enoch reports, the result is enlightening.
It's a dirty business, but the result is illuminating, literally. The Green Girls Project in Cameroon teaches young women to use technology to get ahead. But project leaders discovered that they had a bigger challenge on their hands.
One of the girls approaches me and asks me, "Madam, we don't have light, so how do we use these books and all these things, educational tools you're giving us?"
It turns out the solution was right under their noses. The project partnered with a local energy company to install equipment that converts human and animal waste into an energy source. It's ground together, then poured into a biodigester to produce biogas.
I think instead of us going to buy gas outside, we can use biogas because it will be much cheaper. And with biogas that we use, that we create ourselves, we can get sewages or wages from, we can get pawpaw peelings, banana peelings, and make our gases. And due to that, we'll be able to produce our energy, to cook and to have light or electricity in our homes.
The gas can give light and power to small appliances in a country where only about 50% of the people have regular access to electricity. The project is also teaching the women about other forms of renewable energy, like solar panels. So far, the project has put biogas into 3,000 households, and the demand is rising. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Wednesday, March 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I am Shaka Fali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss International Women's Day. It's also known as the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace, celebrating women's achievements throughout history. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you.
Mobile, 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 Laligio.
The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.